bright, sunshiny weather, I think, probably produces some bright, sunshiny faces, so it's nice to see it all this way. This morning, we're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 23, and it covers the purchase of a field and a cave for Sarah to be buried in. At first glance, it looks like a bit of a macabre kind of chapter. It seems to be sort of all based around death and burial and kind of disappointing or not very happy. And there is that element to it. But don't let that depress you. I think there is something there. I think there's two things in this chapter that are there that are fairly important. One is what it means, what that purchase meant for Abraham's descendants, the Jewish people, and the continuing importance it has. And then I think there's a bigger picture there, and it's sort of unsaid, it's unspoken, but it seems to have been lived out on a continuing basis throughout the remaining years following this purchase. And we're going to be looking at that, and hopefully it will strike a chord, because there's things going on today in our days here in our province that a lot of people are concerned about. And I think this message hopefully will kind of strike a chord and speak to those concerns in some way. And it creeps in. The present day creeps in when you're preparing for talks like this. I think these talks need to be within life. They can't be apart from life. It's really hard to be very objective about the material in which we work, because the material that we are looking at, the Bible and God's Word, it's very subjective, right? It's supposed to touch your life. It's supposed to touch your heart and change your soul. So when you're working with it and you're looking to present it and talk about it, it's very difficult, and I think you should have life impacting on that. And so, well, there. Now, you know what to expect. Previous, though, oh, thanks. Don't want to repeat it 2 weeks ago. Previous to this, at the end of chapter 22, can anybody remember? If you've got your Bibles open, well, I should probably have mine open. At the end of chapter 22, what was there? What was the end of chapter 22? You can just sing out. No? Nobody wants to be interactive this morning. There's genealogy, right? And so you're going from this genealogy at the end of chapter 22, where it tells sort of the specifics of Abraham's brother and his children, and then it moves on at the beginning of chapter 23 into Sarah died. And that seems like quite a shift. And I think to our minds, it is a jump. But I think I would suggest to you that according to an ancient way of thinking, there is a connection there, and I think it was meant to be taken as a connection. When ancient people are looking at their genealogies and where they came from and where they're going, and when they're reminded of this through genealogy, so-and-so gave birth to so-and-so, what is implicit in that statement, in that information, is not only that people are coming together and producing offspring so that the offspring can carry on, but also that when you have offspring, you're passing on whatever you have to them. So there's this idea of inheritance that's implicit, in the genealogy. So it's important. You remember, when God is reaffirming to Abraham, and he's saying, Abraham, I'm going to give you all the land that you see. What is Abraham's response? This was a while back. He says, what good is it if my heir is my servant? You've promised me all this land, this inheritance, but I have no one to pass it on to from my own loins, as it were. I'm passing it on to my favored servant. So in Abraham's mind, in the ancient mind, there's this link between children and offspring and inheritance, or the passing on of material things. Conversely, to have children, if you don't have anything to pass on to them, that would be a shameful thing as well. Keep all these things in mind. They may seem like random thoughts, but this is all going to come together. Turn your attention to the screen. This is a very blurry shot from Google Earth. What it is, though, is Searchmont, Ontario. Hold on, let's see. There we are. There's Searchmont. You can see Searchmont there. There's the Beaulieu River winding through. The road that you see running right to left to right, that's the Whitman Dam Road. Many of you have been up there probably, fishing, hunting, or just exploring. You're probably familiar with this area. And as you cross, as you turn right at the Whitman Dam Road, and you turn on the Whitman Dam Road, you're going to pass a few houses, and then you're going to cross a Bailey Bridge, which is the Atchigan Creek. And as you cross the creek, you're going to pass a few more houses, and over here, you can't see it from the road, but that big spot up there, that's a gravel pit. But in that area, you flip around, there's sort of this clearing right there that you can see right there. That's where my dad grew up, right in that area. And Grandpa René Robert, he owned pretty much that entire lot right down the river. Or actually, the river was in a different spot. It changes over the years. But it got subdivided and subdivided. And right now, that little bit of land is all that's left. My uncle, the oldest brother, my dad's oldest brother, he had that land when my grandpa died. So I moved on to Uncle Al. Uncle Al died, and he hadn't been paying his taxes on it for some years. So following Uncle Al's death, his wife at the time called up my dad and said, do you want the property? It was in his name, but he hasn't been paying the taxes. You can have it for the back taxes. My dad jumped on it because it was a little piece where he grew up. And I identify with that. I would be very upset, I think. Not just I think, I know. I'd be upset if somehow that bit of land, as small and tiny as it is, would pass out of the family. And I know that Dad's remaining brothers and sisters would be upset, I think, if it came out of the family. They're all happy that he bought it. I'm not sure how willing they were to have bought it themselves, but they were pleased that Dad still owns it, that it's still in the Robert family name. There's something about land. I'm not sure. I think I'm identifying with some people. And it's something that we've been losing over the generations because we're not as attached to the land as we used to be. The land, somehow, and I think I think it's God. I think God built something into us, that there's attachment to the earth that he created. He created us from the earth, and he told us to work it, to enjoy it, to get something out of it. And the land is very central in the covenant promises to Abraham and his children. And what we're going to see in this story that we're going to look at in chapter 23, it really is about this attachment to the land. So, chapter 23. When Sarah was 127 years old, old lady, she died at Kiriath Arba, now called Hebron, in the land of Canaan. There Abraham mourned and wept for her. Then leaving her body, he said to the Hittite elders, "Here I am, a stranger and a foreigner among you." Keep that phrase in mind, okay? I am a stranger and a foreigner living among you. "Please sell me a piece of land so I can give my wife a proper burial." I'm going to switch versions. "I'm a temporary settler among you. Grant me ownership of a burial site among you so that I may bury my dead." Now, this is a fairly big request, and it's actually kind of unprecedented. Think about it. Abraham, what does he own in the land of Canaan at this particular point? Nothing. Nothing. He has rights to a well in Beersheba, but he doesn't actually really own the well. He doesn't own the land in which the well sits. He doesn't own anything. And that is par for the course in his time, in his area. What he says, "I am a sojourner," some translations say sojourner, temporary settler. I'm gonna stick on sojourner, I think. "I'm a sojourner," it was more or less a legal term, a statement of his residence within the land. Early on it says he was a sojourner when he went down to Egypt for a bit. So it was sort of this resident alien kind of status. He didn't own anything, but he was living there. Not squatting, necessarily, but it'd be close. And the people in the land, that were of the land, that had ownership of it, that's how they would view Abraham and his group, his family. Temporary people that owned nothing, that sometimes we have to squabble with over water rights and the like, but they move around. They're not from here. So, when Abraham goes to the city of Hebron, because it was a city, the name Kiriath is city, and Arba was somebody, so it's the city of Arba. So it was a city, so it's a settled domestic group of people that were there, and they owned the land that Abraham was living on and using. So when he goes to them and says, "Sell me a piece of land," that's almost unprecedented. For a resident alien to ask to buy something. I want you to appreciate, just let this sink in a little bit. Appreciate the craziness of Abraham's request. Not often done, if ever, this kind of request. And considering the attachment of ancient peoples to their lands, the idea of carving off a piece of it and giving it to someone, as likable as Abraham may be, that is going to strike some people a little wrong. And so it's important that Abraham goes to everybody And he makes this very public. And it says he goes to the elders. So everybody that's important within that area is present and accounted for. Because everybody has a stake in this request. Grant me ownership of a burial site among you so that I may bury my dead. The idea of this burial site and the ownership of it is that Abraham is asking that they sell him something that would be an inheritable inheritance, an inheritable piece of land. Not only that he would use it for as long as he was alive and then move on, but that his descendants would inherit this piece of land. So it's not just, he's not renting. He's not asking for rental. He's asking for something that he might own in perpetuity. Also huge. Not only asking for a piece of land, but that asking that it would remain in his possession forever and ever and ever and ever. The sons of Heth answered Abraham, "Listen." Now, you have to appreciate, I think you should appreciate what follows, and it sounds a little strange and stilted when you read it now, after all these years, in an English translation. It sounds kind of stilted, but it's very legal language. What's going on here is a ceremony, and certain rules that we're not aware of are being followed and observed, okay? So, the whole listen, that is a legal kind of thing. Making sure everybody has the attention, as it were. These are important proceedings. "Listen, you are a mighty prince among us. You may bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will refuse you his tomb to prevent you from burying your dead." What is the response then? Abraham has just asked for an inheritable piece of land to bury his dead, to have for his descendants in perpetuity. And how do they respond? "Why don't you borrow one?" So, right off the bat, there's a certain reluctance, right? There's a reluctance to give this temporary alien, this sojourner, anything that's theirs. And that's understandable. Next step. Abraham got up and bowed down to the local people, the sons of Heth. The sons of Heth, that's where the Hittites come from. Then he said to them, if you agree that I may bury my dead, then hear me out. Ah, so important milestone has been reached. They haven't said, no, you can't bury your dead at all in our land. They have given him permission to at least bury his dead. And that's an important milestone right there. They haven't turned him away completely. They're open to the idea of him burying his dead on their land. Although their first suggestion, of course, is that he borrow a tomb. So Abraham takes this as encouragement, and he says, if you agree that I may bury my dead, then hear me out. Ask Ephron, the son of Zohar, if he will sell me the cave of Machpelah that belongs to him. It is at the end of his field. Let him sell it to me publicly for the full price, so they may own it as a burial site. So step one, he's gotten permission to bury his dead on Hittite land. Now he's asking again for a specific piece. So initially he asked if he could bury his dead and have something to bury his dead in general. And they said, we're okay with that idea. But now he's asking for a specific piece. He had something in mind all along, of course. He wants the cave. He just wants a cave. And it belongs to somebody already. It's in a piece of land that Ephron already owns. So in the presence of all these witnesses, He's approaching Ephron. Notice that he didn't approach him directly and ask, because that wouldn't have been enough. Because the stakes are so high for a temporary sojourner to be buying a piece of land, the whole community has to be involved, okay? So, he's appearing before all the elders to ask a particular individual if he can buy his cave. Now, Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth. Ephron the Hittite replied to Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth before all who entered the gate of his city. This is very legal language. No, my lord, hear me out. Listen, I sell you both the cave, the field, and the cave that is in it. In the presence of my people, I sell it to you. Bury your dead. Was that what Abraham had asked for? No. Abraham just wanted a cave. Now, it's open to conjecture a little bit. And what some people, if you're going to assume a bit of the worst of Ephron, what Ephron may have been thinking was, okay, if I sell him just the cave, I'm only going to get so much. But maybe if I put the pressure on, he'll buy the entire field. And also, maybe if he's faced with the possibility of buying the cave and the field, maybe he'll just back out and not want to buy it at all. And maybe he'll just go away. That's a little disingenuous, but I don't think it's necessarily a question. We like to think the best of people, right? But just the way this whole conversation is going, it seems a little strange. He didn't immediately say, yes, I will give you the cave, which you asked for. No. He expands it and says, take the field. Abraham had really no use for the field. He just wanted the cave to bury Sarah in. Now, some translations say, I will give it to you. I'll give you the field and the cave. The word, though, is meant to convey the idea of selling. Ephron never at any time was going to give Abraham, this temporary alien, any land. That just wasn't done. This is a legal transaction. Money was going to be exchanged, or Abraham was going to walk away with nothing. Okay? So even though, I mean, the English translation is a little misleading in that area, where it looks like Ephron is being very magnanimous and very generous and wanting to give him something, it was never the case, ever. And it's all part of the Middle Eastern way of buying and selling, too. Abraham bowed. So next step. Abraham bowed before the local people and said to Ephron in their hearing, hear me, listen, if you will, I pay to you the price of the field. Take it from me so that I may bury my dead there. So, if Ephron was hoping that Abraham would walk away because he didn't want a cave and a field, he was mistaken, because Abraham calls his bluff and says, okay, I'll buy the cave and the field together. Now what? So now, Ephron, this is the next step. Now he's obligated to name a price, because Abraham has accepted his revised offer. Abraham wanted a cave. Ephron offered a cave and a field, implicitly saying, they come together as a package. You can't just have a cave. If you want a cave, you have to have the cave and the field. And Abraham responds, okay, name your price. So now he's obligated, because this is legal, this is a court as it were, he's obligated to name a price. Ephron says, hear me, my lord, listen. The land is worth 400 pieces of silver, but what is that between me and you? So bury you're dead. We have no way of knowing if this was a fair price or not, because there's really no comparison that anybody's been able to find as to whether this was fair or not. 400 pieces of silver, the pieces, the way that was translated, was an actual weight. And what that weighed out to, more or less, the scholars tell us, is about 10 pounds of silver, which at today's prices is about $2,500, I think I looked it up, which doesn't really seem like a lot. So it seems fair to say that it probably wasn't worth $2,500 in value in Abraham's day. It was probably worth a lot more, but we're not sure how much more. We just don't know. And really, the price doesn't matter too much in this story, because Abraham doesn't haggle. He says, so Abraham agreed to Ephron's price and weighed out for him the price that Ephron had quoted in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 pieces of silver according to the standard measurement at that time. It's almost like it's a report, it's like a receipt the Bible is printing out here for us. This is a very legal transaction that took place in front of witnesses. Ephron, maybe he was trying to talk Abraham out of wanting to buy anything at all in a very underhanded way, but Abraham called his bluff, had the money, and paid it out. Done. Now, it wasn't quite done, because it goes on and says, so Abraham secured Ephron's field in Machpelah next to Mamre, including the field, the cave that was in it, and all the trees that were in the field and all around its border as his property, in the presence of the sons of Heth before all who entered the gate of Ephron's city. Again, very legal, very specific, telling us exactly what Abraham had bought, exactly what Ephron had sold to him, and everything that was in it. And it sounds like a property description, because it is. It's a property description. After this, Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the cave of Machpelah next to Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So Abraham secured the field and the cave that was in it as a burial site from the sons of Heth. And that's the end of the chapter. But what does it all mean? So now Abraham has the first bit of land that God had promised to him, and he bought it for 400 pieces of silver. It was an important time, because the matriarch of Abraham's family, the one through whom Isaac came, and therefore all the covenant promises would be fulfilled through, Sarah was a part of that. I think we often think of Sarah as a footnote, but she wasn't. If Sarah had not wanted to have gone and moved from Ur of the Chaldeans to Canaan, I very much doubt that Abraham would have gone. It's hard to do things on your own. When you're a couple, when you're a unit, you have to be in agreement. So when God called Abraham, he's also calling Sarai, and they both had to be in agreement for them to go. So Sarah was just as much invested in this whole move as Abraham was, and she was just as much invested in the covenant promises of God as Abraham was. And you can see, as she comes through in different points in the story, when she's really trying to make this happen, God has promised us a son, but he hasn't given us a son, so here, take my maid. That was hard. That would have been a hard thing. Here, take this other woman so we can have children. That's not an easy decision. And now, after all this, at 127, Isaac, 37 years old, Sarah dies, and now Abraham's thinking about, where am I going to put her? Because he's a sojourner. He's a temporary resident, and he has nowhere to bury his wife. So he takes these fairly big steps. These are fairly big steps. And this is a fairly important chapter for Abraham and for his descendants to now take possession of the land that God had promised to them and have a burial site. And it was so important that not only did Sarah get buried there, but Abraham was buried there. And not only was Abraham buried there, but Isaac and Rebekah were buried there. And guess what? Not only were Isaac and Rebekah buried there, but Jacob and Leah were buried there. You know where Jacob was when he died? He was in Egypt. He was a very long way away. But as he was laying dying, he said to his sons, "Don't bury me here. Promise me that you will not bury me here in Egypt. You're going to bury me in the cave of Machpelah that my grandfather bought from the sons of Heth." Years later, you have old Jacob that's holding on to this possession. There they were in Egypt, and all they had was this field and this cave back in Canaan, a land that they were forced to leave because of the famine. And he wanted to be buried there because he said, "We're going to go back. We're going to be going back there because God promised that land to us." So there's a sense when you look at this cave and at this burial site where the importance of the possession gets passed down from father to son, from father to son. And all the children take a hold of that and they hold it close and they say, "This is important." And you know, right now, in Israel, there's this mosque sitting over the burial site, or the supposed burial site of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob and Leah. Because not only do the Jews find this important, but of course, so do the Ishmaelites, because Father Abraham is buried there. And they've been sort of fighting over it for years. 1967, the Jewish forces finally sort of freed it so that Christians and Jews and Muslims or Arabs could all go and visit. It's still important. Think about this. Could it be, though, that when Abraham was called by God to leave his home, and God gave him these covenant promises, and he says, "I'm going to make you a blessing, I'm going to make you great, I'm going to give you descendants beyond number, and I'm going to give you land that's your own forever." Was that all it was to Abraham? Think about it. Was that all it was? Was Abraham just a shallow kind of guy to whom the promises of God were only just about being great and having lots of kids and having land? Think about that. Think about that. Because he left his home and he went to live in a tent. Abraham lived in a city. He lived in a house. He was probably fairly well off. He was domesticized, as it were. He didn't have to work that hard because he lived in a progressive technological society. But God told him to move. He told him to go somewhere else. He didn't even know where at the time. Go to a land I will show you. And he lived in tents. He lived in tents until the day of his death. That's quite a shift in lifestyle, is it not? Imagine, and I purposely made those graphics be more like it would have been for us. Like, imagine living in your home with your white picket fence, your orange picket fence, and going to live in a family-sized tent for an determined amount of time in some other country. Venezuela, how about? Where you are, you don't own anything. All you have is your tent and your family. That's what it was like. That's what it would have been for Abraham and Sarah. What compels such a person to do such a drastic thing, to pull up roots and to go? Is it just for land? Is it just for descendants? Is it just so that his name would be great? Is it just for that? Is that all it's for? I don't think so. I think those are important parts of the covenant. But I think that's not all of it. I don't think that's why, ultimately, Abraham pulled up roots and left and went and followed God. Could it be that Abraham, as imperfect as he was, and we've seen a lot of his mistakes in the past few weeks, could it be, though, that ultimately Abraham had an experience of God that made him want the God of the covenant and the God of the promises more than anything else? Could it be that he was looking for a heavenly city? He left the city that he was in, that he'd been raised in. And he went to live in tents. But it wasn't about the physical and the tangible for Abraham. Because I don't think that would have been enough. I don't think all the land in the world and all the kids in the world and all the greatness in the world can make you want to pull up roots and make such a drastic life change. But when you experience God in a very real way, I think some pretty crazy things happen. And we read about this in Hebrews. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents as the descendants, Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. And believe me, they knew it. And we're going to go on and we're going to see how God reiterated and confirmed his promise and his covenant to Isaac and Jacob and the descendants after them. And they knew it, for he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. That's the kind of stuff, that's the motivation that compels us and moves us to do crazy things, to do things for God. The other stuff, those are things that God has promised, and those are important. But what it is, really, is an experience of God himself. Now, when Abraham and his sons, when they're passing along, because it's important, right? We were talking earlier about how important it was for ancient peoples to pass along their land and that attachment that they had with it. But what's even more important? Because if the land as important as it was, I suggest to you, wasn't as important for Abraham to move from where he was to a land that he did not know. So what is Abraham going to pass along? What's even more important than the land? I suggest to you that the values that Abraham got from his experience with God, the beliefs that he had about God, and the ideas that he had about God were even more important. And that he passed those along to his son. And I've been thinking about that. And I realized how important it is to me to be able to have that right and that privilege with my own kids. Because we live in a society that seems to be throwing it away as fast as they can. The last week, if you've been following in the news, has been all about this new sex ed curriculum that the government of Ontario is going to impose on our public schools come September. And there's a lot going on about that. There's a lot of opinion all over the map. And you know what? It's an important thing because people are losing friends over this. People are having real issues with their relatives about this. It's a divisive thing. And it's no good to say, well, it shouldn't. It shouldn't bother you that much. And people are saying that on both sides. It shouldn't bother us. It shouldn't bother you that much because it's obvious that it's really good or it's obvious that it's really bad. You can't just say that. People are bothered by this in whatever way and for whatever reason. And that's a bigger issue. I don't want to get right into the sex ed curriculum. I'm trying to stick to this. But what this whole issue has done for me anyway, and in thinking about this idea of passing along my values, beliefs, and ideas, is that deep down, I value the position that God has put me in as a father to pass along what I've learned and what I've experienced. And the ability and the privilege that he has given me to speak that and live that into my child's life. And if you have kids, and if you're thinking of having kids, I think that is one of the single most important things that God has given to us to do, and he's done it on purpose. Despite the fact that we're all going to speak different things into each of our child's lives, the values, the beliefs, the experiences I've had are going to be very different from the values, beliefs, and experiences that you've had. But you have the privilege of speaking that into your kids' lives. God, I think, has meant you to do that. Because we all have a different experience of God himself. But if they're all true experiences, then it's all true. Because God is bigger than any one of us, right? God is bigger than the sum of us. So if we can all have really true experiences of the same God, and he's allowing us, inviting us to speak those and live those experiences into our, pass that along into our kids' lives, that's a big thing. I think that's a very, very important thing. And for that to be taken away is no small thing. I think it is no accident that the primary unit of God's working in this world is the family. The primary unit is the family. When you have a nation with strong families, you have a strong nation. Because those families continue to produce strong families. And those families produce larger family groups, produce strong communities. Those communities produce strong leaders who make wise decisions for their communities. The primary unit in God, of God's working in this world is not the church, because the church is made up of families. And if the family is being eroded, friends, then we have no foundation. So when I look at this story and I see Abraham and how important it was for him to pass on not only his land, his burial site, but his experiences of God, and it specifically says that in Hebrews. He passed along, he's looking forward to that city, which is God, ultimately. And in Deuteronomy, as God is starting to sum up sort of all the laws and the commands that he's given his people, he says, very specifically, place these words on your hearts. Get them deep inside you. Tie them on your hands and foreheads as a reminder. Teach them to your children. Talk about them wherever you are, sitting at home or walking in the street. Talk about them from the time you get up in the morning until you fall into bed at night. God intended his law and his commands and his values to be lived out every day, all day, every second, throughout our lives. And that we are to impress upon our children the reason we are doing these things. Why do we need to be kind? Why do we need to be honest? Why do we need to have integrity? Why do we need to turn the other cheek? Why do we operate this way in business? Why are we not going to look at that on the internet? Why are we choosing not to read that? Why are we choosing to read this? Why are we choosing to spend our time in these activities and not in others? Why are we eating this and not this? These are all things that we live each day. And God intends us to teach them to our children. It's important. And our society is giving it up. And the argument that I've heard, especially around the issue with the curriculum, is parents aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. True. But neither is it the government's responsibility to fill in. All of this speaks to inheritance. God has this interest and this theme, it seems, throughout the Bible of passing along valuable information, valuable things to his people. And the theme, the idea of inheritance is woven throughout Scripture. And ultimately, with Christ, we are invited as fellow heirs, as adopted heirs, into the family of Christ. And that's a key theme in the New Testament, is it not? Where we are the strangers. We are all to identify with Abraham in that respect. We are strangers and sojourners in a foreign land that land of which we know nothing. We are in it, we are living in it, we are using it, but we don't own any of it. But ultimately, it belongs to God, and God has promised that we will take ownership. Not of the land of Israel. I think God still intends to fulfill that promise to his people Israel, that they're going to have that specific, he was very specific about what the boundaries of that land are going to be. But ultimately, through Abraham and through his descendants, all of us are made heirs. And all of us are going to take possession of the world. But it's not about the land. It's about God. Some pretty big thoughts there. To go from a legal discussion on this resident alien trying to buy a bit of ground to bury his wife in, to thinking about inheritance. But I think it's there. I don't think I've stretched it. Let's thank God for his thoughts today. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the stories that you've put in it and the things that you're trying to tell us. I believe, God, that you've given us all a right and a privilege to experience you, and a right and a privilege to pass on those experiences and the thoughts that we have of them to our kids, so that our kids in turn might be excited and inspired to have their own experiences of you, and therefore just keep passing it on. And I think this is implicit in the story of Abraham buying a field in a cave. Lord, I thank you for each one that's gathered here. And I pray for our country, our province. Lord, you know everything that's going on. And you know the fear in our hearts. And we just pray that you would take that fear away, that you would cause us to trust in you fully, to recognize that you are in control of all. There's nothing which is outside of your authority. I pray that we would continue to pray for our leadership, and that we would continue to be respectful, and that we would continue to be full of grace, your grace. These things I pray as we go forth from here. In Jesus' name, amen.